Let me invite you to open up your Bibles to 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 7. We'll look there in just a moment. Good to see each one here this evening. And as I mentioned this morning, as Andrew's speaking about, we're going to talk about using our wealth to help others. And as I mentioned this morning, we have a great deal of it, and therefore a great responsibility. Much has been given, much is required. And I want to talk about what is required of us, what that looks like. We speak about the need for charity from the standpoint of attitudes. And Andrew spoke about that in the lesson and the songs that he chose and the songs that we've sung this evening. We speak about it from the standpoint of compassion, of recognizing what God has done for us, and all of those things are fundamentally important, having the right attitude, having the approach. And I want to talk a little bit about that this evening. What we rarely speak about is the actual implementation of how we actually go about that. And usually, I'm afraid it works like this. Maybe we have a guilt trip sermon, right? We ought to be doing more. We ought to be helping people. And so, in response to that, there is the looking for an opportunity to give somebody something, and we have brief and quick interactions in which we exchange resources, usually some cash, and we feel better and less guilty, and we can go about our ways. And as far as the way the Bible talks about doing good and helping those who are in need, that really doesn't fit the bill. And it misses in a number of different ways that I want to talk about this evening. As I suggested this morning, in conjunction with the attacks on the American economic system and our interaction with that economic system, the wealth that is accumulated in the wealth in the Western world as a result of such economic systems, there are also attacks concerning charitable giving, the existence of poverty, or not even poverty, but merely a difference of wealth. And so that just income inequality is given as evidence as some sort of negligence, and particularly negligence on the part of Christians. People who are concerned about the consequences of various forms of charity and is this actually doing any good are given the response that, you know, we're not worried. You worry too much about the numbers. And it's not about that. We have to do something. Bob Geldof, who is a prominent charitable person, he gets together celebrities and so forth to help the world. He gave that very response. He was criticized for some of the things that he had done in Africa and the actual consequences of what was happening. And he says, even if it doesn't work, we have to do something. Well, in that case, it wasn't just that it wasn't working. It was actually making things worse. It doesn't matter. Because in his mind, and in the mind of many, charity is not actually about helping the recipient. It's about us doing something that makes us feel good, which is a very selfish way to go about charity. It's supposed to actually help. And so we need to be thinking in those kinds of terms. Like passages regarding wealth, instructions regarding the giving of aid to the poor are too often stripped of all biblical context and supplied in their singular form as cudgels to demand a fairly narrow view of how we go about helping the poor. But the Bible has much to say about the poor and about helping the poor, and all of it bears consideration. I want to bring some of those maybe less viewed context into consideration this evening. In 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and in verse 7, it tells us familiarly that God loves the cheerful giver. And this is where we're going to begin this evening, is that notion of being the cheerful giver, that attitude. And I want to think about that really from two sides. And so to begin with, I want to suggest to you that in our giving, charity is not coercion. And in fact, if it is coerced, then it is not charity. Like, those two things cannot go hand in hand. So a lot of times people will criticize the American economic system and say that the economic system in and of itself is not generous. Well, let me just suggest to you, economic systems cannot be generous or not generous. Only people, individuals can be. And they can be within an economic system, they can be generous, or they can be miserly within any economic system. What you cannot do is be generous with other people's money. And so too often that moniker is placed on somebody who says, I'm going to collect all of your money and I'm going to give it to these people over there. Aren't I generous? No, you're not. Your money is the only thing you can be generous with. So you've coerced generosity out of other people, but that's not generosity at all. Some people are so confused about this that when they read Acts chapter 2 through chapter 5, they actually see a form of communism or socialism. The Washington Post and the New York Times over the years have run several articles. There were two recently in the Washington Post in which it was deriding Christians. One of them I thought was a pretty hilarious title. He says, it was Glenn Beck's worst nightmare. The early church was socialist. And the only entertaining part of reading these articles is that these people have written more about the Bible than they've ever read from the Bible. And that's what this fellow had done. He had assumed things. He had assumed things about Acts chapter 2, and he had really ignored what most commentators say, and in fact what the text itself, more importantly, says, and had just assumed that since there were people selling things and giving those things to others, that's socialism, that's communism. Well, in fact, that's not socialism or communism. Because in socialism or communism, what you have is somebody saying, give me your stuff. You really don't have a choice about it. If you don't, I will put you in prison, and then I'm going to give that to somebody else. That is not generosity. That's not voluntary giving of our means. And that's certainly not what's going on in Acts chapter 2. As you read through Acts chapter 2 and you begin to see that here are these people, it is a unique situation. People have come from all over the world to worship in Jerusalem, and unexpectedly they're staying in Jerusalem. And that's a key element. They had come expecting to return home soon, but now they're there. They're there longer than the provisions would allow them to be there. And if they're going to continue hearing the gospel, there's literally nowhere else in the world at this moment to hear the gospel than in Jerusalem. They can't go home and, you know, podcast the rest of Peter's sermons. They need to stay in Jerusalem. And so their brethren provide for them to do so. And they do so by, as of course it tells us, by selling the things that they had. As it tells us about this, and it goes on talking about those things. It says verse 44, all those who had believed were together and had all things in common, and they began selling their property and possessions and were sharing them with all as anyone might have need. Now, the word began there is a little bit misleading in the New American Standard. It's the supplied word. As you look up the tense of the verb, it's the idea that they were selling on a continual basis their property. Now, there's several things to notice about the selling of the property here and in chapter 4 particularly. First of all, that ongoing means they didn't just make a lump sale. It didn't just all happen at once. Everybody got rid of the property. They all threw it into a common pot, and then they began to pull out of that. But rather, they sold portions of what they owned and then did lay that at the apostles' feet for distribution among the saints. And of course, we see that when that gets more complicated in chapter 6, some other elements are brought in to manage those resources. But the idea would be that they sold property as the needs arose in order to meet those needs. Another thing that we see here is that they're continuing to meet in houses in the houses of the people who live in Jerusalem, which means again that they didn't sell all their property. People still owned houses in which people could meet. So again, this is not somehow following the instruction to sell all that you have and give to the poor, but rather that they did maintain personal property, and so the property that they're selling must be excess property. I would suggest that that's what's being described even with Barnabas, who owned a tract of land and sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. That's not That's not the house I'm living in. That's attractive. I mean, even its description suggests it's extra property that I own. He laid it at the apostles' feet. Well, then, of course, there's Ananias and Sapphira who sell a piece of property and lie about how much they sold it for. They keep some of the proceeds for themselves and then give some to Peter. And, of course, the punishment is not for the keeping of the proceeds. It's for the lying to the Holy Spirit. And Peter's words are very specific and very helpful in sort of combating the idea that this is coerced generosity. In that he says, Ananias, verse 3, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and keep back some of the price of the land? While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, was it not under your control? Why is it that you have conceived this deed in your heart? You have not lied to men, but to God. So Peter's argument is not, how dare you keep some of the money? It's how dare you lie? And that's really the only consideration. It's the only problem here. He posits, you could have kept it. I didn't tell you you had to sell it. You could have sold it and kept part of the money. Both of those options. You see, that's what he's implicating by saying it was your own. You had choices here. I did not say there is no command. There's no injunction for God saying you must do this. So not only is it not like government coercion, even the preacher here, even the preacher of God's word is saying God is not coercing you. He is not telling you you have to do this. This was all voluntary. But you wanted credit for more than you were willing to do. That is the heart of the problem. And in fact, that's the heart of the problem with so much generosity, because people engage in it not to actually help people, but to receive praise of men. That's what's going on with Ananias and Sapphira. Their motivations were wrong from the core. If they had engaged in this to help people, they wouldn't have cared if anybody knew what the price was. They would have followed Jesus' instructions and kept it as quiet as possible as they handed that money over, really saying nothing about it. But they do care about that. And so we see multiple elements throughout this story that distinguish it from any notion of a mandated or required charity in the way that certainly socialism, communism talks about, but even very often the way religious people talk about it. Over in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, where Paul is admonishing the Corinthians to remember their commitment to help the saints in Jerusalem who were in the midst of a famine. 2 Corinthians chapter 9, and in verse 7, each one, he says, must do just as he has purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. Sometimes we feel like because we're being given instruction that says, here is a good thing to do, that that's like compulsion, but it's not. I have this conversation at home with some frequency. So my daughters might, there's some times where I give compulsive instructions, right? You will do this or this, right? So it is like the government coming in and instituting something. There's punishments if you don't. But then sometimes I'll say, I would like for you to do this. And they hear that word. They go, you'd like for me to do this, or I have to do this? And I say, well, I'd like for you to do this. Are you going to be mad at me if I don't do that? No, I'm not, because I'm very careful with my words. And I don't say I would like for you to do this if I mean that you have to do this. And I don't say that you have to do this if I mean I would like for you to do this. So they're two different things. One is a request that you have the option to either receive or reject. And the other is direct command. And there's a different response for those. And so sometimes they sort of timidly test that and they go, okay, well then I'm going to stay home and not go with you guys to wherever it is you're going. And it's almost like they're looking to go, is it really just a preference, or is there a compulsion here? And as much as possible, I try to live up to what I've said. All right. I'm going to let you make your decision. Now, then they might say, but you prefer I go. Yes, I stated my preference, right? So it's not like I haven't told you what I wanted, but I've left you some freedom in this realm, in this expectation. I haven't said, this is what you must do. And I think with regards to charity, there's a lot of element, a lot of room where God says, I'm leaving you a lot of leeway here. Now, at the end of the day, does God require some element of benevolence? Absolutely. But he never seems to get to that point to say, this is precisely what I expect of you. But rather what he wants is a generous spirit. And he says, if you can't give from that, you just keep your money. It's a very important distinction. Going back to chapter 8 of 2 Corinthians, chapter 8 at verse 7, look at the way Paul is even reminding these Corinthians. He says, but just as you abound in everything, in faith and utterance and knowledge and in all earnestness and in the love we inspired in you, see that you abound in this gracious work also. I am not speaking this as a command, but as proving through the earnestness of others the sincerity of your love also. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. I give my opinion in this matter, for this is to your advantage, who were the first to begin a year ago, not only to do this, but also to desire to do it, but now finish doing it also. All through there, he's saying, I'm giving you my opinion. I'm not commanding you. I'm just saying, this is something you said you wanted to do. Again, here's something I do with my daughters. Not only do I express my preference, but I remind them of their own commitments, the things that they've said that they want. So they say, I don't know if I want to do that. Okay, well, I'm not going to make you. They go, really? You're not going to? No, I'm not going to make you. I am going to remind you that you said you wanted this, and if you don't do this, you're not going to get that thing that you said you wanted. You're not going to end up where you want to be if you don't participate in this. And I think that's, Paul is making a case and he is trying to persuade, but at the end of the day, he's not saying, I am coming in to knock heads if this collection's not ready when I get there. I think he does say, it's going to be embarrassing for you because you said you would. And everybody else is jumping in and participating. And you were the guys that first started. In fact, I've been telling everybody about, it's going to be really embarrassing for all of us. But I'm not commanding you. Because that would be useless. It doesn't help, especially the giver. There is no benefit to the Corinthians, for sure, if charity is coerced. And so all along, what he's trying to get them to see is that if you're going to give, I want you to give because you see the need. Because you're spurred on by the actions of those around you and you see the generosity and it builds a generosity in you. But if you can't get there, we'll just deal with the embarrassment. Right? We'll figure it out and we'll move on. But this is so very different, for instance, from 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Paul doesn't talk like this in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. He doesn't say, listen, whatever you guys decide, I wish you would do this. It's just my opinion. No, I mean, he drops it down and says, listen, there's no tolerance for this. The very next time you come together, you mark that man and get him out of your midst versus, just want to remind you of some things. So you see a vast difference in the approach. I think we have difficulty with that. We have difficulty thinking about things that are good to do, but we're not required to do. To say to our children, I think it would be really great for you to do this. A lot of times what people mean when they say that, they're just being manipulative. And what they really mean is, you better do this or else. If you say, I think it would be really good for you to do this, that's what you ought to mean. So that if they go, yes, I agree, but I'm still not going to do that. Okay. That's similar to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. I think it'd be really good for you guys to not get married. I'm not saying you sin if you do, but I think this would be most helpful. And I think in terms of charity, that especially from the standpoint of if this is going to create bitterness, if you're going to give grudgingly and you're going to hate your brethren in giving to them, and a lot of people give charitably and then scorn those that they give to, then don't do it. It's not helpful. It's not helpful to them because you'll hate them, and it's not helpful to you because you'll hate them. And so the desire, creating the desire, is a fundamental element. Now, do we need to create that desire? Yes, that's kind of a different subject. We don't start at the end game saying, you got to give this much money. We start with, you need to look at your brethren this way. You need to look at poor people this way. And if you can't do that, then there's no sense in talking about what you should do about it. So we start with building compassion. All right. I want to talk just a moment about indentured service and the year of Jubilee in the Old Testament. Trevor read a portion of Leviticus chapter 25 for us, and that's where the law of the year of Jubilee is most expounded upon. We see it as a shadow. Jesus himself talks about being that year of Jubilee, that pronouncement of the freedom of those who are in bondage. But notice, there's some particular elements. There are people, again, who pick up the Bible and are looking for mere justification of their political views and will take Leviticus chapter 25 and say, see, here is forced redistribution of wealth. And the same thing is true in Exodus chapter 21, that you have somebody who's an indentured slave and God comes in and says, I say, you give up what's yours. But notice that it's not really like that. Rather, there are clearly communicated rules in place. And so that as you're reading down through the law about the year of Jubilee, he tells verse 13, on this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his own property. If you make a sale, moreover, to your friend, or buy from your friend's hand, you shall not do wrong to another. Corresponding to the number of years after Jubilee, you shall buy from your friend. He is to sell to you according to the number of years of crops. In proportion to the extent of years, you shall increase its price. And in proportion to the fewness of years, you shall diminish its price. For it is a number of crops he is selling to you. What we have here is essentially God exerting his authority over this promised land. It's his land. And these tribes are making usage of it. And with his authority, he is saying, what I do not want to happen is for that land to be lost among the tribes, or worse yet, among foreign nations. And so I'm going to set in place a generational reset button that is going to continually bring the land back to the original family owners. Now, what that does is, along with Exodus chapter 21, where it's every 7 years, somebody who sells their services into slavery is also set free. It would be a similar situation that at the end of those 7 years, you're free. It keeps somebody from spiraling out of control into debt. Or in the case of 50 years, it keeps people from generationally spiraling out of control. But there is the reality on both sides. So that if somebody says, I just can't make ends meet, I'm going to have to sell my land to somebody else, the person buying the land is able to know the law of Jubilee and say, well, it's been 30 years since Jubilee. I can only buy this land for the next 20 years. They know that, right? It's not like they're just conducting transactions and then, you know, it's like Pop Goes the Weasel. You're waiting for the music to end and bam, all your wealth is gone. But he says, no, you enter in knowing you're buying 20 years worth of usage of this land. This is actually the way that they do business in Fiji. They similarly are worried about the land being lost from the native population. And so they do not allow legally most of the land in Fiji to be sold away from the native ownership, but only leased. That's essentially what's happening here. You're allowed to lease out your land. And so maybe you buy a 100-year lease, right? And then somewhere along the way, you want to sell that land. Well, maybe you sat on it for 30 years, so now you can sell 70 years of usage of that land. So you can still conduct transactions and property can change hands, but ultimately, everybody knows these people, it's still theirs. Notice that's the way it talks about it. The year of Jubilee, you shall each return to, each of you shall return to his own property. Right? It never becomes really not yours. It's still yours, you've just leased it out to somebody. So the notion of somebody coming in, and really they're reading something into the text, talking about redistribution of wealth, that's not it at all. In fact, what's happened is the contract has expired. And what God says is, I'm setting the expiration date of all land contracts every 50 years. I'm exercising my authority to do that. He's determining the length of leases. So that if an Israelite wanted to say, well, I want to lease out my land for 100 years, sorry. You have to renegotiate that at the end of the next Jubilee, and then you could do that. Or an indentured servant says, I'm going to sell myself into slavery for the rest of my life. No, you can sell yourself for 7 years, and then you can renegotiate, and you can rethink that. I'm going to hit the reset button for you so that you're going to have to rethink that in 7 years. But again, none of that is a coercive relinquishment of wealth, but rather a regulation for specific purposes, sort of a protection measure for a number of different reasons to hopefully keep his people from falling too far from the blessings that he has provided from them. So I think those are important contextual realities that need to be brought to bear in response to some criticisms. Well, I want to think about the causes of poverty. A lot of times we're talking about helping the needy. This is, again, a ridiculed element. What does it matter why they're poor? They're poor, and so we ought to help them. Well, what it matters is that knowing how someone got into a predicament is very helpful in being able to figure out how to help them out of that predicament. And there are very different reasons for why people end up in poverty, and they call for very different solutions for how to get them out of poverty. So, first of all, looking back to Deuteronomy chapter 15, there's an interesting statement that God makes here in Deuteronomy 15 and in verse 4. As he is giving instructions of the Sabbath year, he says in verse 4, however, there will be no poor among you, since the Lord will surely bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance to possess. Well, then why the need for all these laws about the poor? He just said once you get there, there won't be any poor. And the idea, of course, is that if everybody's behaving themselves, if everybody is doing exactly what they ought to do, then this is true. If everybody's following God's laws and behaves just like he wants them to, the land will be blessed, they will be blessed, there'll be no need for considerations of helping people who have fallen by the wayside, because there won't be any of those. But of course, that's not the case. And God knows it's not the case, because in the very same context, he goes on in verse 7, just as he has just said, even after he's just said, there will be no poor, he says in verse 7, if there is a poor man. I think about this a little bit like 1 John, where he says, I write these things that you may not sin, but when you sin. And so the idea is certainly, I've given you the game plan to avoid sin. I've given you the game plan to avoid poverty. But people will not avoid sin, and they will not avoid poverty. And that will be for a number of reasons. And so, if there is a poor man with you, one of your brothers, in any of your towns, in your land which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor close your hand from your poor brother. Again, in verse 11, he says, for the poor will never cease to be in the land. Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall freely open your hand to your brother, to your needy and poor in your land. And so we end up at pretty diametrically opposed places where God is starting off saying, there's not going to be any poor there. And then after a few verses, and really relatively very few verses, he's saying, really, there's never not going to be poor people. So there's never going to be poor people, or there's never not going to be poor people. One is the ideal, one is the reality. And we need to appreciate that. That there are patterns of behavior, there are ideals that if they are in place and if they are followed, then yes, poverty would be abolished. God himself, communicating those very ideal rules, more ideal than we'll ever come up with, and with the power to bless in a way that we'll never have the power to, says, but poverty will not be abolished. That's a reality. And it's a reality that we live in. That is not a condemnation of the system God put in place. You see, what he's saying is, my system is good. My system would provide for no poverty. Poverty will still exist. Where then is the problem? It's not with God. And it's not with his system. Sometimes people see poverty and they say, the system. Well, if it's not this system, if this system could have poverty, every system will have poverty. I'm reminded of Jesus' words in Matthew 26. They very much echo these words. The poor you have with you always. Now, I don't think that we should take away from that, the poor you have with you always, and say, then don't worry about it. That's not what I'm saying. It will always be a responsibility. But we need to be careful that we don't think that the fundamental problem, if we see poverty, the fundamental problem is a system out there that is causing all of this. It could be, but it's not in this case, which means it's not in every case. And so we need to evaluate and see what's going on, what is causing the poverty in each individual case. Well, one thing that certainly causes poverty is oppression. That people with greater power and wealth oppress those with less power and wealth. That's what James talks about in James chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. Come now, he says, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you, and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields, and which has been withheld by you, cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. You have lived luxuriously in the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. This is the sort of passage somebody might go and say, see there, it's the rich are the problem. It's the rich who defraud and withhold wages that are the problem here. It is the rich who exploit and take advantage of people who really don't have much power or recourse to go against them. In other places, in other contexts, the rich are a great blessing to those around them. But in this case, they're a great curse. So some people are in poverty because they are in circumstances, whether it be powerful government officials or whether it be powerful economic powers that are taking advantage of them. And maybe those economic powers are voluntary. Maybe they're not voluntary. Maybe they are coerced relationships. But the bottom line is, very often, people in power can take advantage without much in the way of consequences. And James says, God will bring the consequences. So, we need to know that. And if people are in poverty because they're being oppressed, then helping them in that poverty involves figuring out how to deal with the oppression, how to get them away from that if possible. May not be possible. In which case, we've got to figure out how to help them while they remain under that oppression. So those are some considerations. Natural disasters cause poverty. That's what's going on in Jerusalem. It is described in Acts chapter 11 and verses 27 through 30. This famine that would be coming that is predicted by the prophet Agabus, that he was said would really affect much of the world. And that seems to be what's affecting Jerusalem or Judea at the time that Paul is on his second and third journey, and he's bringing relief there to those saints in Jerusalem. Well, that's a temporary thing. Natural disaster is something that happens, and it may sweep through a whole area and involve really everybody in that area, or it may sweep through an area and only involve some people. When Hurricane Katrina came through, you know, anybody within a certain distance of the coast in this particular area was affected. It wasn't like, you know, the wave could skip over your house and just hit the guy next door. And so I remember having gone through some of some interaction with people after that and trying to help with some people after that. And so it created, I think, a little bit of a mentality. And several years later, when the tornadoes came through Alabama on April 11th, or is 2011, April 27th of 2011, when all those tornadoes came through, north to south, I don't know how many tornadoes touched down. So people all over the state are affected. But tornado acts differently than a hurricane, and so it hopped over. And one of the interesting things about that is I was in Montgomery at the time, and people in Montgomery knew that I had a lot of connections in Birmingham and North Alabama, and they called me and said, does anybody need help? And I had called churches in Russellville. I'd called churches here in Athens. I'd called churches in Huntsville and over in the Walker County area, just all over the place, Tuscaloosa. Everywhere I called, they're like, we got it covered. Really? How? I'm like, well, you know, look, three or four of our members got hit hard. Most of us fared pretty well. Now, the area is devastated, but we've done pretty well. And they needed a place to stay, and so we gave them that. But then insurance paid for them a hotel, and so it's all taken care of. And so I reported that back to some of the brethren who were asking me about that, and they said, isn't there somewhere we could send some money? And they just really wanted to help, and I appreciate that they really wanted to help. But the fact was that this particular natural disaster was not the same as that other natural disaster. And so what we expected, the need that we expected, was not there in the way we expected it. And so a lot of the generosity was declined. And we found that in multiple places where we actually went to those places. We did find opportunities, but just not quite what we expected. Nothing like Katrina, for instance. So, natural disasters occur. Individual disasters occur. That's what's happening with widows and orphans. That's not a sweeping natural disaster. That's a disaster in some individual's life. The husband has died. And so there is someone who does not have the same capacity to take care of themselves, whether it be the widow or the children or both combined. And so that's who James particularly points out. It is people who have gone through a personal disaster. In Luke chapter 10, and in verse 30, that is a description of a personal disaster. A man was going down to Jerusalem from Jericho and fell among robbers. This isn't everybody in this area got hit by. This is a man in a situation, and his circumstance is that he's been attacked by robbers. He is left half dead, as it says, on the side of the road. And all of these are not the fault of the person who's in poverty. But even in these cases, we must address them differently. There are needs that are going to be ongoing because of some of these disasters. There are needs that are going to be very temporary because of some of these disasters. There are some of these disasters that we're going to be able to move past with time or with distance if we can just get them away from it. There are going to be some of these disasters that you just have to continue to live under and figure out how to manage. And so as we approach people in these circumstances, these things are helpful to know. But the Bible also gives us really extensive passages to point to self-inflicted poverty. Now, the most pointed way that this happens is in Proverbs, the description in Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 4, for instance, that we read this morning. The poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. In chapter 13 and in verse 8, the ransom of a man's, chapter 13, verse 8, the ransom of a man's life is his wealth, but the poor hears no rebuke. No, verse 18, poverty and shame will come to him who neglects discipline, but he who regards reproof will be honored. So when you don't pay attention, when you don't heed good advice, when you're lazy, all of these things lead to poverty. In the case of the Old Testament, one of the things that God says is sin. In that case, will lead directly to poverty, and maybe even more directly than for us. Because God is saying in a very direct way, I will bless and curse the land based on your actions. And I think that there are some similarities that we could even broaden this out from laziness. As you look at, again, studies that are done, there was a senator from New York many years ago, back in the 70s, who, I think he hired some research done and then came away with just a small list of things that you could do to stay out of poverty. You know, like an 87% chance of staying out of poverty if you don't quit school, don't commit a crime, don't do drugs, and don't have a baby out of wedlock. Like an 87% chance. Now, you might say, but then what if somebody does those things? Are you saying they're in poverty? I'm not saying that, but I am saying that there are very distinct ways to very consistently stay out of poverty in a just and free society. When these other elements aren't there, right? When you're not being oppressed, when there's not a natural disaster, when there's not a personal disaster, all things being equal, Proverbs is in harmony with all of that, that basically, you know, hard work, clean living, wants and needs in check, or desires in check, and you're going to be all right. And you're going to live a fairly comfortable life in most places if you follow the path of Proverbs. So, we want to know, is a person in poverty because they've ignored this? And if that's the case, then that's part of, it's a great deal of what needs to be brought into play. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 10, again, a lot of people roll their eyes when this is brought into a discussion of helping the poor, but it's a critical element. For even when we were with you, we used to give you this order, if anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either. This is really strong language. You withhold. So it's not that I condemn someone to poverty because they have messed up, but they may be condemned to poverty if they hold fast to their folly. If somebody says, I'm going to keep doing the things that got me here, well, then I cannot help you. Right? The path out of this is changing the behavior that got you into this. That's not the case in these other cases, but it certainly is the case in this last instance, that it is going to be instruction and a change of behavior. So I've dealt with people frequently who have just totally made an utter failure of listening to anything Proverbs says about money. And they come and can you help? And in the immediate, in the first interaction, sure, you know, need a light bill paid, need some gas to get some, that's fine. Second instance, okay, something going on here. Third instance, now, this is not somebody who has fallen on an occasion, some individual instance, into need, but now we got a pattern. And one of the things I ask people, I say, okay, I want to help you. But it appears that giving you money on occasion is not solving the problem. Let's talk about what the Bible says about money.
And you'd be, well, you may not be, amazed at how many people get affronted at that. Do you want out of this or not? And I think people assume that their own wisdom that has led them to this state is somehow going to lead them out of it at some point. It's not. God's word and God's wisdom is what's going to lead you. And in fact, what Paul said is you may have to give them some really strong motivation to get out of that. So, if the problem is that you're ignoring God, then my help comes with telling you what God says. And if you reject that, then you reject any help that I can give you. I think that's what Paul's saying. If you don't want to hear what God has to say, then you don't want help from his people. Well, how do we actually go about helping people then? Talk about determining the causes of poverty. And I suggest to you that that will affect the solutions that are most likely to relieve it. So in the first case, I think that we need to consider a priority of responsibilities. Who am I responsible for taking care of? We've talked about this in other lessons. But there are concentric circles of responsibility. And so Mark chapter 7, one of those concentric circles is I think described here or implied here. Mark chapter 7 beginning verse 9, it says, he was also saying to them, you are experts in setting aside the commandments of God in order to keep your tradition. For Moses said, honor your father and mother, and he who speaks evil of father or mother is to be put to death. But you say, if a man says to his father or his mother, whatever I have that would help you is Corban, that is to say, given to God, you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or his mother, thus invalidating the word of God by your traditions, which you have handed down, and you do many things such as that. I think we could expand that principle. That what Jesus seems to be indicating here is there's a very primary responsibility in taking care of your parents and taking care of your family. Paul would indicate that in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 4, that the one who does not take care of their family is worse than an infidel. Right? So, when you think about Jesus putting that even above the temple, there are some people who would refer to, you know, Matthew 25, to God's instruction on charity, and they would say, see, we're supposed to be charitable, and they'd leave their own family wanting. He says, no, they're first. You take care of them, you make sure they are cared for. Galatians chapter 5 and verse 10 gives us a sense of priority. Do good to all, especially those who are of the household of faith. And so again, concentric circles. That circle eventually gets out to the whole world, but it starts with family. And then maybe a little bit more distant family. Our local congregation is a personal responsibility for everybody here. Christians at large is a responsibility. And finally, the whole world is a responsibility. But as we're looking for where to help, we may run out of resources before we get to the end of that list. Maybe we're in an area, and I think we are in an area, where our families are taken care of, our local congregation is taken care of. We don't personally know, maybe, of situations, at least that we're confident about, of Christians that are in need. But then maybe we do see some people in the world. But understand that if you get there, it needs to be through that process, and you do not neglect the first in line in order to take care of the second, third, fourth, or last in line. And we need to consider this both on the part of the giver and the receiver. I said that 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 4 is worse than an infidel. That's not that passage. But here in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 4, as Paul is talking about widows indeed, he says, honor widows who are widows indeed. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, they must first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents. For this is acceptable in the sight of God. So, I've had interactions where somebody says, I need some help. I knew their family. I said, what's going on? Why'd you fast? I don't know. I don't know. They just want help. Well, let's go talk to them. Because they really ought to. I know your family and I know they could help and I want to know what's going on. Now, it may be that this guy's not telling me the whole story, and that's happened quite a few times. But then it may be that his family needs some rebuke. And they need to hear, hey, this is your job. And don't take that job away from them. So, family responsibility, not only for my part on the giving, but also the person who's asking, the person who's receiving, I want to see, is there somebody else who takes priority who should be taking this role instead of me? Incidentally, that's what Boaz does. He makes sure that the other person is going to relinquish his responsibility before he takes responsibility for Ruth and for Naomi. Think of the long term as well as the short term. Our goal is to actually alleviate poverty. We don't want to create poverty and we don't want to create dependence, really. And so Paul, thinking in the long term, as he's talking about widows here, he comes on down to verse 11. He says, but refuse to put younger widows on the list, for when they feel sensual desires and disregard of Christ, they want to get married, thus incurring condemnation because they've set aside their previous pledge. At the same time, they also learn to be idols. They go around from house to house, not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies, talking about things not proper to mention. Therefore, I want younger widows to get married, bear children, keep house, give the enemy no occasion for reproach. Don't make a dependent of somebody who does not need to be a dependent. He describes, here are people, very particular circumstances and situations who it's appropriate to become permanent dependents of someone. Here are people that it is not appropriate, certainly, to become permanent dependents of the church. And he says, if you make them such, there will be consequences. You are encouraging laziness. You're encouraging bad habits. You're encouraging eventually someone to get closer to the devil because you thought you were going to be nice. And you didn't think about the long-term effects of your charity. Well, that's not very charitable. So I want to actually help this person. So when I give charity, I want it to be something that considers the dignity of the person that I'm giving it to. In Leviticus chapter 19, beginning in verse 9, one of the primary ways that in the Old Testament that they were to provide for the care of the needy, Leviticus chapter 19, beginning verse 9, it says, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. Two elements there. Leave the corners of your field, and as you're going along and stuff drops in the course of picking up the grain, leave it. Don't try to grab up every scrap. And what does that do? Well, it gives opportunity. It's an open door for people. And so what you're doing is you're saying, I will give you an opportunity to work and to feel good about what you're taking home because you got out in the field and you harvested that. And then you're the one that's got to go home and you got to sift that wheat and then you've got to grind it and you've got to make the bread out of it. I think too often we think in terms of, it's almost like our charity is the exact opposite. You know, we're demanding that people go harvest all the grain and then you grind it, you turn it into a product, you go sell it, make some money, and then just give that to them. And it doesn't help them. In fact, like just when secular studies are being done, that kind of just easy approach. Like we're given tons and tons of money. $2.3 trillion have been sent to African nations. And they're just now over the last decade beginning to study the effects of that. And it's disastrous. It's not helpful. So what they're doing is they're beginning to invest now in saying, let's teach these people how to work. And let's teach these people skill sets and teach them, give them the ability to do for themselves and give them dignity instead of dependence. And robbing them of dignity. All the while feeling pretty good about ourselves because we're their saviors. But we're really not. So I think there's a real beauty and wisdom here. Not only
not only does it provide for work, but it provides for two elements of need. Come and get food right now. You can take it home and eat today. And come and get seed. And you could go plant this and do something with it. And you could begin to work your way out of this situation with the help and the generosity of the people who are around about you. One more element that I want to bring in here, and that is that I think we need to plan for generosity. So I think we need to look and see where people are, what can be done to alleviate this. Is this a situation where we're just going to need to take them onto the rolls, as 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 1, or is this a situation where we need to get them off of that aid as quickly as possible? What can we do to provide them opportunities to provide for themselves? That may mean that you give them a job that you would not have normally paid for someone to do. Maybe you say, hey, could you come cut my grass? I don't normally pay somebody to come cut my grass, but I would pay you. And wouldn't that be better than just giving them 30 bucks or 40 or 50 bucks? Say, here, let me give you something to do so we'll both feel good about this. But in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 12, 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 12, we have similar language to 1 Corinthians chapter 16. He says there, if the readiness is present, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he does not have. One of the difficulties about charity because we don't plan for it. And, you know, we might say, I don't have any money on me. And I do say that frequently. I don't carry cash on me. But from the standpoint of being charitable, Stan Bullington was teaching a class on this at Profitable for Teaching a few years ago and gave me this idea. He's like, you know, here, what we have may be determined by how much we've planned to have. Paul says, lay by in store. I want to, when the time comes to actually give this generous gift, I want it to actually be there. And so I think in addition to planning to give on the first day of the week, one of the things that we began doing as a result of Stan's advice is in our monthly budget, we say, we're going to set at least this much aside for charitable giving. Now that's not the top limit, but it's the bottom limit. And we're going to look for ways to spend this money and to help people. We're not going to wait for somebody to say, I need money and then go, maybe I can, okay, I guess I could find it here. Now there may be times when somebody comes and needs money and it's somebody, it's a need that I know and I may have to dip past my budget. That does happen. But to make it a purposeful thing. But then you're already thinking about it. And then you're thinking about how could I show some charity? How could I show it in a way that reflects what God says and does not deny or ignore God's wisdom on the subject, but actually hopes to help people in those interactions, actually hopes to get them out of the situation that they are in as much as possible. Isn't that what we're going for? A lot of this is talking about sort of reining in some of our, I think, carelessness in the area of charity. Now, some people might say, well, I'd go for a lot more carelessness. And that may be in some instances. Maybe somebody doesn't do anything charitably, fine. But I think there's so much irresponsible charity, and I think there's so much irresponsible language surrounding charity, that we just as much need God coming in and saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. Let's think about this a little bit more. Let's think about wisdom and let's think about purpose. What's the real goal here? And how do we actually accomplish that? And so God's wisdom certainly gives us direction there. We are the five-talent man in America. And so we have under our care the things that the Master has given us for our usage. He does say, I am not going to come in and force you to give this much. But he does say, remember how much I've given you. And that's the kind of language Paul uses. And he hopes to motivate us. But we don't want to be people who don't care if
engaging in that charity actually accomplishes or something or makes the situation worse. We want to be people who are reflecting God, who seeks to actually lift people up and approaches people with that mindset. And of course, with that in mind, what we want to always remember is that the gospel takes priority over any physical charity. There's a great many people whose lives are in ruin and they are in poverty. And one of the things that I think we need to understand is most especially when that poverty is self-inflicted, nothing will help them better than the gospel. It will help them to both get a better viewpoint of living in poverty right now, and it'll also give them the path out. And so we need to be more about talking to people about the gospel just as much as trying to lift people out of their physical wants and needs. James says, if you look at people and you see them in need, and all you think is, man, I hope that gets better, be warmed and filled, you don't even have faith. You don't have real loyalty to the King. And so I hope that we begin to see those needs and think hard and do the hard work of engaging with those needs in a biblical way. If you're not a Christian, understand God has been so lavish with you. And like the Israelites, so many times we ignore it and we don't think about it. We don't remember that He is the source of all those blessings. But I hope that as we've gone through this today, you'll think of it in those terms. And I hope that would just be one single element of you responding to His generous love and care for you. And if you'd like to make that response this evening, we'd rejoice with you if we could help you in any way. We should come while we stand and while we sing.